Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You're scared of things that go boom, boom, boom.
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric, I'm here with Michael, and we have a dirty, dirty fucking double feature today.
Dirty fucking.
We got two films that are about taboos, for one, but also about bored women, which I think is kind of interesting. What are the movies we're doing?
We're going to cover John Waters' Polyester and Steven Schoenberg's Secretary. There's too much alliteration.
That's
there.
A lot of alliteration,
I was
just going to say. So here's what I'm thinking. We watched the movies in the order, Polyester and then Secretary.
Mm-hmm.
And normally you want to put the funnier one second, as we've discussed many times on the show, because you don't want to bring things down. However, to preserve the ideas in Secretary that it's completely normal, I'm going to see if we can just casually go right from Polyester to Secretary, like no big deal.
Okay.
So we're going to start with Polyester. I think there's a little bit of spoilage, maybe in Secretary, not so much in Polyester. It's a John Waters fest, I think. If you're concerned about spoilers, then you should have watched the fucking movies, first of all. But you can also use the chapters to skip between the movies. You can do that in iTunes. And if you have lyric support on your MP3 player, it'll also tell you the track times. You like that feature? That's brand new.
I have no fucking idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, it'll tell you track times so you can skip to the next movie.
I don't know what lyric support is.
Try and find that or just use iTunes.
Is that like a podcast?
One day, Michael Kester, one day. Let's talk about Polyester.
All right.
This double feature sort of mirrors something we did last year on the show.
Yeah.
It was actually one of the double features you set up at your place.
Yeah.
It was Fur and A Dirty Shame. We have the same directors here and sort of similar movies. Again, we're dealing with taboos, really heavy theme in both of their work. So John Waters is a guy who's concerned with a lot of things. Taboos.
Or is he just concerned with so little?
Yeah, that could be it too. That really could be it. A very free-spirited man.
Yeah.
John Waters is one of my favorite human beings alive. And it almost looked like we weren't going to get any more John Waters movies in this year, or any John Waters movies in this year. So we had to put a stop to that and make sure we got at least one in. Taboos is an obvious thing, but I think he has a lot of interests that make their way into his work.
Mustache grooming.
Well, yeah, he's known for his characteristic facial hair, his pencil-thin mustache. He's joked about, you know, looking like a child molester. This is a guy who pushes the buttons of suburban moms all over the country. This is the first of his movies that we've done.
That has a plot.
That got an R rating. The first of the movies he did, rather. We've only done, you know, A Dirty Shame. Some of his mainstream stuff, actually all of his mainstream stuff really came later in his career. This was the first thing that even bordered on mainstream, although we still see a lot of the Dreamlanders cast. Divine, we'll talk about for the first time on this show. We'll get to talk about Divine. But what I think is really interesting about this, just for double feature, is that this is kind of a callback to an exploitation genre we've never really talked about, and one I'm not really familiar with, which is women's pictures. It was this subgenre, or maybe even a subgenre of a subgenre of exploitation in the 50s and 60s, you know, written on the wind, films like that, that focused on bored housewives or unfulfilled housewives, which was a big market, a big demographic I think that's genius to hear that that's, or to have read that that is a exploitation genre, because we always think about basically our demographic, right? We think about cars. We think about monsters, we think about
killing,
gore, slashers.
Motorcycles.
Yeah, but what about all the housewives who aren't doing anything and who are kind of sad by that and want to go out and see
themselves
really portrayed on screen, seeing bored housewives get into all sorts of trouble. I mean, that's
a thing, I guess.
Totally a market, and I'm really surprised that I was so naive. I never thought about it. I'm almost a little
ashamed of yourself.
I am.
You really should be.
That's what any good John Waters movie does, is makes you ashamed of yourself. There is something about John Waters and his films that just makes me extremely happy. It's sort of like comfort food. It's really strange. There's very few filmmakers. A lot of people have films that they'll put on when they're in a bad mood or whatever. But of all the films I've ever seen, not having even seen all of John Waters' films, I know at any point when I'm having a bad day, I can put on a John Waters movie and my entire life, everything will just be fine. It'll all be better. And I think part of that is honestly restoring my faith in humanity. Here you have a guy who, let's face it, he's an older man. he's a filmmaker, so by, you know, pure stereotype, he just has to be a liberal guy. Mm-hmm. But I just think it's really refreshing to see someone not in, you know, our age demographic, right, who is okay with all these social issues. Oh, in fact, more okay even than I think I
probably
am. You know, who's not, he's been around the block, clearly, and is not afraid of these things in a way where you see a lot of people in our society who aren't okay with social freedoms. They're old people, and they just never grew with the culture. They're still afraid of the taboos from when they were young adults. And I think it's interesting to look at John Waters as a man who, over the years, as society decided, you know, as really our whole country decided, they were okay with different things. John Waters was like, yeah, I'm fine with that too. Maybe he was even fine, you know, with that before anybody else
was. I'm pretty
sure
he's just really easygoing. I'm pretty sure. In A Dirty Shame, there's this scene toward the end where they start talking about sexual shit that's okay versus sexual shit that's not okay.
Right.
And the general rule of thumb that kind of shows up is, as long as it's safe and consensual, it's fine. And I feel like that's kind of how he feels about everything. As long as it's safe and consensual, it's okay.
That's a total libertarian stance, too, on sexuality, personal freedoms. You know, if you're not harming another person, we, one, don't need laws against it. I mean, I think that's obvious. But two, I don't think we need to be afraid that our neighbors are doing it. Both of the films today are kind of concerned with that idea.
Frisky neighbors.
Yeah, frisky neighbors. Well, you see John Waters' movies taking place in, you know, suburbia all the time. Suburbia. Well, Baltimore, But these places that I guess are generally considered conservative America or in the Bible Belt, Christian America, where people are really uptight about social issues. And John Waters makes his films there, first of all, which is great because that means he has Divine running around at 4 a.m. on people's lawns screaming, which is just great to, you want to talk about pushing people's buttons. Yeah. I'm sure suburbia loves that shit. And then also creating the movies and putting them out, which has a larger audience than just the people in that particular cul-de-sac whose minds he's trying to blow.
The difference between being on the cul-de-sac and watching Divine run around and being in the theater is that you get to actually smell the movie when you're in the theater.
Well, we've had a problem for a long time, which is if John Waters is filming a scene in your neighborhood, you can go over and sniff his film. But in theaters, people could not do this. So John Waters invented Odorama. So what Odorama really is... we've kind of seen something like this on the show before. What was the director?
William Castle in the, what was it, House on Haunted Hill?
Yes, when we did that with Clue, which was a great fucking time. William Castle was known, and we talked a lot about that in that episode, so you can go back and hear about the different gimmicks he had, which were brilliant. But that was a big inspiration for John Waters. William Castle, just a brief primer here, was a guy who relied a lot on different gimmicks to get people, to get asses in seats, basically. He would do all sorts of things. I won't ruin it. I'll try and convince people to go back and actually listen to that episode. But a lot of really innovative things and really hokey things and just fun stuff. And so John Waters said, and you can tell by watching the movie, that this wasn't a kind of thing where they went, you know, they wrote a script, like with 3D today, where you write a script and then before you start filming, you go, you know what, I should do 3D. Let's get the cameras for that. Or where you write a script and add something in post. This was a script written to exploit Odorama, which is the particular scratch and sniff technology that's used here. They had like smell-o-vision and stuff before that. Yeah. We should give a brief description of what Odorama actually
Odorama is. Odorama, unfortunately, I wish I could say Odorama is this magnificent discovery, but unfortunately, Odorama is a scratch and sniff card with coordinating numbers to what pop up on the movie
screen. Can I tell you something really, really terribly sad?
Please.
So you didn't know about this till just now. I'm going to break your fucking heart. I tried desperately for the last 3 weeks to get us an Odorama card today. I really did. I looked on Craigslist. I was all over eBay. I couldn't even find... There's legends. There's tales that you can find Odorama cards for hundreds of dollars on eBay. But I couldn't even get a hold of one. They're not even listed. I was really hoping... And it probably wouldn't even have any smell left. It's been like 30 or 40 years.
I'm sure it would have its own...
Its own unique
its
smell
own unique
from the...
smell.
It would smell like John Waters fans is what it would smell like.
That's awful.
So there's 10 smells total. I believe I have them all written down.
Right.
But if you can remember in chronological order, what are the smells?
All right, I'll give it a shot, but you're going to have to help me out here.
Sure.
Get me rolling with the first one.
Roses. Okay, so you remember the opening scene.
Yeah.
Which there's a joke in there about widescreen, which is really nice that the movie starts in full screen. scene. And then as Odorama is explained at the end, the doctor, I guess, of scientist of the Odorama, chemist. Yeah, pushes the sides of the screen out into widescreen. Very theatrical. So the first one is roses. Yeah.
Okay. And so then we have farts.
Yes. Fart was the next one.
Is the third one pizza?
That was the fourth one, glue.
Glue.
I remember glue always because they had a problem after the movie went into theaters when it came to home video or whatever, and they were still trying to put out cards. They wouldn't let them put glue on the cards because it's encouraging people to sniff glue was kind of the joke there, which is a shame that they had to replace that.
So then fourth was pizza. Fifth was gasoline?
Gasoline, yeah, which is the scene, of course, when Divine... You can tell that they have a library of available smells, and so they just wrote them into the film. Divine is a drunkard at that point and is sniffing some gasoline.
Right. What's the sixth one? Is that the sneakers?
Skunk.
Skunk?
Yeah, you got a couple more. Skunk? There's the skunk, and then there's, I believe it's gas from the stove, although I was never really like clear on
gas
that.
Or something.
Right, right. New car smell.
New car smell.
And then you had it with the old sneakers. That's a good one, too.
I like that one a lot. I that's my favorite one.
Could you explain what happened
so
in the movie at
that point? So there's this wonderful moment where Divine walks in on her new husband and her mother fooling around, getting frisky.
Right.
Frisky neighbors. And she's all upset, and her mother's like, oh, calm down. Smell these roses. And Divine goes in to smell them, and then it starts flashing the number.
Yeah, the audience reaches down to their card. Oh, some more roses.
And then her mother pulls a old switcheroo and puts sneakers in front of her face.
It's the best gag. It's great not only to exploit these gags, but that they're written so well to put stuff like this in here. And then the last one, I believe we covered them all, is the air freshener.
All right.
Finally, at the end of the film, you can purge your senses of all of the... all the awfulness, really, that's gone through the film. What I kind of like about this, and something I know John Waters is really proud of, is that he's performing a little bit of a thought experiment here. I guess it's not even a thought experiment. It's a real experiment. Mm-hmm. He's going, if you could not smell farts, if you had the option, would you still smell them? And in theaters around the country, apparently.
Everybody was sniffing number two.
Yeah, people looked at the movie screen. They heard a fart. It clearly Divine did not like the smell of the fart, and then they reached down to their cart and scratched it and smelled it themselves. Thank you for that experiment, John Waters. You've contributed to the scientific body of knowledge. So in his early films, which we're not prepared, I would say, to tackle.
No.
I just feel like as a show, we haven't, maybe year six, we'll finally get to those. But on year two, we still have to play it a little safe. His old films used a cast of characters that have become typical of really a lot of great directors uses the same characters over and over. But a lot of people call them the Dreamlanders. I think that's kind of how they're known. There's a couple of them in this film, but I really wanted to talk about Divine because Divine is playing something of an interesting role here.
Yeah, Divine plays the straight man.
Yeah, and that's what's weird to talk about Divine as a straight man because of all of the complicated layers to that.
Yeah.
But in a movie where you have... I mean, let's run down the characters. You have alcoholic, pornographic cinema owner. You have crazy dancing daughter who's getting an abortion.
Right.
Who can't stop. Did you notice
this? Yeah, she can't stop
I think
stop
she
dancing.
Has maybe 3 minutes of not dancing in the entire film.
Then you have the cereal stomper for a son.
The foot stomper is how I remember this. Yeah. I mean, you always remember Odorama, but man, foot stomper is an image, an idea really that I just can't burn out of my mind.
And then you have the, what's her name? Cuddles? The rich debutante.
Debutante, yeah.
And Heinz, her servant man.
See, so here's the thing. It's Edith Massey, who's awkward, I guess is one way to describe that. Edith Massey's a staple.
She's as smart as she is beautiful, I think.
Early John Waters. This is such a prototypical John Waters character.
Oh, yeah.
And she plays a debutante, which of course makes me think back to the Aristocrats. And so I think it's Hans, but I think Edith Massey can't actually pronounce O's. I think that's what's going on
there. That could be it.
So this is a big role for Divine, because Divine is kind of playing in what is essentially a comedy, of course. Divine is playing a very serious role.
Yeah.
And he's still like hamming it up. But all the theatrical makeup is gone. The persona of Divine, it's not films starring Divine. It's Divine moving into more serious territory. I'm kind of curious, do you think that led to this film finally skirting on the mainstream, or where do you think, what do you think separated this from the older stuff so that audiences kind of more of them saw it.
Well, there's a storyline. I mean,
yeah, sure.
It's less of a collection of weird scenes. Sure. There's a lot less of those strange music montages that right. are really apparent, especially in Pink Flamingos, mm-hmm. where people tie meat to their penises and flash women in the park.
Right.
I'm going to credit Odorama for this film's popularity Great. Because I feel like John Waters made a movie where Odorama fit. Yeah. And in order to do that, it needed a plot.
Yeah, I could see that.
He needed to make a movie where someone was encountering all of these smells.
Right. Well, we haven't even really talked about the whole reason that there is Odorama, but Divine, this is a superhero movie, essentially. Pretty much. Divine's character has a really great nose, a really sensitive nose that sometimes gets her into trouble. And she smells things from, you know, upstairs and outside the house. The smells are almost like clues. They lead yeah. her to the different plot points throughout the film. And indeed lead the audience to scratching the next number mm-hmm. off of the card. So yeah, you're totally right. I think the smells helped structure. Whoever thought we'd be talking about
John Waters thought it.
How That's smelling, true. Yeah, really, helped the structure of the film. So it made the film a lot more pointed. And I think there's also, I hate to blame the ratings thing, but this is the first R-rated film. I don't think it's an accident that the first film not to get an X rating is also the most successful up to this point. You know, it was distributed more widely and more people could see it. And I think he got away with just as many offensive things, just maybe not the same types. Mm-hmm. You know, there wasn't as much dog shit perhaps, but I think the issue of abortion is a really big one. It's treated in such a comical way yeah. that it's almost more offensive than if it were, you know, tackled yeah, seriously sure. in a more gross manner. I think the fact that they make light of abortion, that's part of the satire of a lot of things in the film. You know, we have to, in talking about any John Waters movie, talk about all of the different things he's not even really lampooning, but just the taboos he's touching on. I'm curious if you found the same ones in the film that I did.
We've got adultery.
Oh, yeah, that's a big one.
Adultery. We've got abortion. Mm-hmm. Pornography.
Yeah, owns the porn theater. Mm-hmm. And there's it's weird. Her new boyfriend, after, you know, the stuff with her husband happens, I guess her new husband owns a theater as well. Not a pornography theater, but a theater, an art house drive-in.
Sure.
But sorry, pornography.
What else? What else we got?
Prostitution, a little bit.
Oh, yeah, there's a little bit of the prostitution. That's right.
Specifically in the beginning, talking about dancing for quarters uh-huh. or whatever, which I find really amusing. I think that's really typical of John Waters, too, to, in making light of a subject like that, take something like prostitution, but dial it down, almost like the South Park episode mm-hmm. where they talk about the kissing booth. You know, it's all the talking about all these ideas of prostitution without calling it prostitution, so we can kind of get past these preconceptions people have.
Right.
And kind of go, you know, is it okay to dance for a quarter? Of course it's okay to dance for a quarter. I feel like, and maybe I'm reading into this a little too much, but I feel like there's a theme of domestic abuse too. Yeah. Now, there isn't physical domestic abuse, but Divine playing this role, I mean, his character is mentally tortured throughout the film.
Oh, yeah. And you can see it on his face.
Yeah, to the point where there is an audible sound that Divine is making throughout the entire film. Mm-hmm. You get these phone calls. You get the character's husband driving around the cul-de-sac yeah. on like a megaphone.
Prank calls. You get prank pizza deliveries.
Yeah, they're just harassing her throughout the entire thing. I feel like if he's talking about something there, it's a little bit of domestic abuse, making light of that. But there's a really obvious one we haven't hit on, foot fetishes.
Yeah, I guess that's kind of in there. It's not in there as strongly as
phone calls and pizza and divorce. Well,
there's just,
you know, you have an entire character who's sort of dedicated to that.
Well, it's almost a foot fetish, but it's more like a foot stomping fetish. I mean, I'm not sure that those are really the same thing.
No? Do you think that's different?
Yeah, I would consider
because one is about idolizing feet and the other is about destroying them.
Well, I don't know. I think that maybe it's a different degree or a different deviation.
What is, not to get too heady here, but what is stomping on feet? I mean, what is the mental process behind what makes a person want to stomp feet?
Maybe he's a sadist with a foot fetish.
Do you think that's it?
That's got to be
it. Is it like a women thing? Is it?
He's only stomping women and they all look alike.
Oh, they do all look alike. That's a strange thing. Mm-hmm. And then almost to make fun of someone like myself who would ask a stupid question like that, he brings home these portraits of feet that he has, almost like now he is celebrating feet.
Yeah.
Now feet are something sacred. Before, feet were something to be destroyed. Although he was, you know, flipping through the book in the opening scene to, and that's more mental anguish for Divine as well, for Divine's character. I'm going to do something kind of crazy with Secretary, and we're just going to see if we can walk through this, but I think you might back me up on this. Secretary is a movie by Steven Sheinberg,
mm-hmm.
and we talked about Fur previously on the show. but I'm going to try and defend Secretary, a film about sadomasochism, as myself a feminist, because I don't think those things are mutually exclusive.
Okay.
I think a lot of people could look at Secretary as, you know, the end of the film with the stack of books,
yeah,
as being anti-feminism, as being anti-woman, because, you know, it's degrading to the woman.
Yeah.
But I think that probably depends solely on if you believe that sadomasochism is an acceptable choice that people can make. You know, when we talked
sure.
about...
They cover it later in mm-hmm. the same scene when her father reads the script from the Bible.
Before we get too heavy into that stuff, I want to know our major players here. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Maggie Gyllenhaal is playing Lee. Likes things to be dull. She wants to be bored. How else would you describe her character?
She's anxious.
Sure. Nervous, I think.
She's nervous and she's willing and she's excitable, but yeah. not excitable in the jumping around Natalie Portman in Garden State way.
Right.
Just excitable in the she likes when things happen.
Yeah, I feel like she's amused by a really small, specific kind of quirks of humanity, really, of other people and of scenarios that happen. It just seems like she doesn't have a lot of experience in the job market, for mm-hmm. instance. You know, when we see her, when we first encounter her, she's been locked up because of these issues she has, which I think the movie is smart not to probe too much. They don't go, why is she like this? Why does she cut? I mean, we learn things about yeah. what kind of person she is and why eventually she needs that, but the movie doesn't get really Freudian.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like your father never loved you and therefore you cut right. yourself. We get little hints of what may have caused that, but that's all left up to the interpretation of the viewer.
Yep.
I don't think the movie's trying to spell that out and go, this is why people
are messed
up. I don't
even think the movie's trying to say that it's that important.
Yeah, well, that's really
what it is. I mean,
that's
a lot of what I think about the film is that I think the movie is trying really hard to go, listen, this happens.
Yeah.
That, and that's it. They're not trying to say, this happens, this is weird, or this happens, fucking deal with it.
Right.
They're saying, listen, this goes on.
Well, and to the film's credit, it has a great awareness that people are weirded out mm-hmm. by it. But it doesn't think, it handles it really well. It says, I know people are a little taken aback by this, but it is completely normal.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to tell a story from a perspective of someone, you know, where we exploit it a little bit, where that's what the reason it's a film, because people are going to come to it and go, ah, that's a little strange. But we're not going to treat it like, wow, aren't these things strange?
Yeah.
Even really when
they're
we're
not
seeing
freaks.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Which leads me to James Spader's character who plays Edward Gray. What kind of impression do you get from him?
He's
a little harder for me to put my finger on than
he's
Maggie
nervous.
Character.
He's nervous and he's really calculated.
Mm-hmm.
He's slow moving.
Mm-hmm.
He is one of the most slow moving characters I've ever seen in film. Everything he does is already planned out. And they touch on
sure.
that when he sits there for a second and says what he's going to say
right.
before he's even in the same fucking room.
Yeah, a couple times.
He's just very...
He prepares for things.
He's very calculated. He knows exactly how he wants things to go. And that's probably why the two get along so well, because she submits to whatever he wants to have happen. And he's very specific and direct about making things, you know, almost in an obsessive compulsive
yeah,
way, but
right.
not without...
Well, when we first see the red markers,
sure.
immediately I think OCD, although we find out later what the red markers are actually used for, it seems like he's arranging things on his desk in a really particular way. What I found really surprising, and I'm curious if you thought this as well, this was your first time seeing
yep.
the film, Secretary mm-hmm. I've seen a couple times. When you think about BDSM, or you think about sadomasochism as a lifestyle, not just as a sexual kink, although it's certainly that as well, you usually think about the dynamic of one person having power over the other person. So maybe you think they're completely different types of people. But just in your description, you talk about how he's a little nervous, he's a little anxious. I mean, does it surprise you how similar these two characters are when you're introduced to them?
No, not really.
So that doesn't shock you at all.
I think that a lot of what goes on when, I mean, okay, so you're dealing with something that may be considered a taboo.
Sure.
Something, you know, dominant yeah. versus submissive, whatever.
Sure.
But the reality is relationships still have to be founded on the same precedents.
Right.
People still need to have... I mean, Jeremy Davies' character, right?
Yes. Yeah.
He says that's what relationships are founded on.
Yeah.
You know, things in common. Having,
I'm sorry, could you mumble that like Jeremy Davies, though?
That's what things are based on. It's, you know... Whenever I do Jeremy Davies, I always want to do him as Charles Manson.
I know. Well, you're amped up right now, and I asked you to take it down to a Jeremy Davies.
And I can't.
Sorry, I've totally interrupted you. What was the point you were making?
The point is, Jeremy Davies, his character, her fiance later
yes.
on, says relationships have to be founded on, essentially, he says, things in common.
Yeah,
they both,
similarity,
for,
sure.
The example in the film is what? They both do their laundry when it's dirty.
Yes.
And the reality is these two characters, Lee and Edward, are both shy. They're both kind of nervous, mm-hmm. and they're not really people.
Yeah.
But that's good, because if one of them was really outgoing and the other one was shy, they would not be a good relationship match, and things wouldn't make sense later on when they start hitting it off.
Clearly a movie written by, or at least influenced by, people who totally are involved in this lifestyle or know what they're doing. That, or the director, as we saw with Fur, is just really, really good at figuring out how these things exist in the real world.
Yeah, how normalcy applies sure. to normal things.
Right, because it wouldn't actually make sense to find someone who's completely submissive and some, you know, powers, gets trampled on all the time, and someone who's dominant takes the power in all sure. situations, because they wouldn't be completely compatible in liking the same things. You have a dynamic where they clearly show they can do either role.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Lee has to, give a powering voice on the phone from the second she steps into the office, actually. And then you have Spader's character kind of running reclusively right. almost from his ex, pretending that, you know, pretending he isn't there, cowering really. But you have the common ground with both of them of really being outsiders, wanting to be isolated from, you know, you see Lee at the wedding party or whatever, when she's thinking about cutting again, she has to get away from the crowd. She can't be around all of those people. You know, she doesn't deal well with these giant groups of people.
Mm-hmm.
So me and you have talked a little bit before the show about the role you think Jeremy Davies plays. Mm-hmm. He's already kind of informed the situation just in our describing the other characters. But what other role do you feel he fits in this
one? I think that he serves to represent a party that may not really exist
mm-hmm.
especially in the audience for the film.
Sure.
I think what he serves
you
to
mean
do...
a part of the general populace right. when we're talking about here's a part of society that's into BDSM. Right. Here's some other people. You think he's a third thing, a different
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, I think that what he serves to do is make the audience feel closer to the BDSM thing. I think mm-hmm. he serves to be even further removed
right.
than the audience, to make them feel like, oh, well, this is weird for me, but it's not that weird for
right.
me. Like, this guy doesn't.
Give me an example of this.
I think the best example is when they're, you know, they first try to start fucking on his bed.
Right.
And she wants him to smack her ass.
Right.
Lays over his lap. And now the audience, as far as I would understand, I mean, I'm not into BDSM so much, but the thing is, I can imagine the audience going, slap her ass.
Right.
I mean, come on, man. That's clearly what she wants to do. And he is even further removed than the audience, going, well, what do you want me to do? You want this condom?
Yeah, that's great when he holds up the condom. From a very objective standpoint, we can stand back as an audience, and maybe some people in the audience in that given situation wouldn't be comfortable with it
right.
and would kind of play his part. But looking at it without being emotionally involved in that, not being one of the characters, not right. being there, everyone can kind of go, well, we know what she wants.
Yeah.
Just smack her
Is
ass.
Is it that
it's
big
fine.
Of a deal?
Yeah, exactly. Is it that big of a deal? I think that's a turning point for the audience.
Yeah, because it's not at that moment. I mean, it's a different thing. When it shows the first time and she's working and it's her boss mm-hmm. and she's reading her mistakes, that's kind of a little bit more taboo than in bed, you know, fooling around.
Right, sure.
That's normal.
It's strange in a film that's so much about sexual dynamics, we find two characters just fucking to be the most normal, by societal standards, the most relatable of any of the moments in the film.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing I want to praise Secretary for, just quickly in passing, we talk about exploitation a lot on the show. We talked about it with the John Waters film. This follows, at least in marketing, some of the, let's say, the credentials of a sexploitation film, especially specific scenes. I think about the scene where she's walking home. It feels like, I don't know if you've ever seen Felicity. It's a really popular Australian sexploitation flick. But
oh,
it's
not
basically
the J.J. Abrams TV show.
No, not
that's
the
what I thought you were talking about.
Which I really
about.
Hope is based on that, Felicity. But no, it's a total sexploitation film about this girl who's just never been with anybody. She, you know, lived in a monastery or something. And she goes out into the world and discovers sex for the first time. Very typical sexploitation flick. What Secretary does that we've urged films to do over and over is take a sexploitation kind of, any really, exploitation or even old film premise, and elevate it to something more. They have on the outside, and what people will tell you Secretary is about, is masochistic lifestyles, mm-hmm. you know, that sort of thing. Weird sexual kinks. On the surface, that's it. That's the marketing ploy. But when you start watching the film, it becomes apparent very quickly that the story is about a lot more. It probes a lot more mm-hmm. interesting questions.
Well, also there's this weird...
It does more than just the typical sexploitation
right.
thing.
Right, well, it's because there's this weird secondary portion of the film that's really cute and heartwarming.
Yeah, it certainly is.
There's this adorable... I mean, the adorable Maggie Gyllenhaal.
Sure.
Because Maggie Gyllenhaal, the sex fiend, isn't what I'm used to.
Right.
But I can totally recognize cute Maggie Gyllenhaal.
Yeah.
Because that's, I mean, that's what I've seen. So when that comes out, I go, oh, right, because she's just a girl, you know?
Yeah,
she's
yeah.
just a cute little girl who has a crush on this boy.
Yeah, it's amazing you say that because I think the exact opposite. A lot of her early work is really... not necessarily sexual, but dark. You know, she plays a darker character in that stuff. But when I see the lighter stuff, it's almost like a romantic comedy without the comedy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is something very cute and very approachable, really.
Yeah.
Very approachable about it. And I think that's why the film draws in those different aspects, because it ultimately needs to be approachable in order to kind of have that conversation with the audience.
Well, that's what it does. It basically removes the comedy and replaces it with this really intense sexual, you know, sexually fueled
sure,
dramatic
sure.
thing. It is a romantic comedy, but they just swap out the comedy for a really serious sex story.
Well, I think the sexual tension serves a lot of purposes. That one definitely, but you almost have sexual tension where you would expect dramatic tension.
Right.
You know, towards the ending of each act to bring you into the next act, you kind of have different moments of her relationship with him. They kind of go to different levels. And there are particular moments where you don't know what's going to happen, and rather than feed you a plot device, you know, oh my God, how are they going to resolve this situation? You're just sort of left, as she is, wondering what's going on in his mind. Why is she not pursuing this? You know, what's standing between the two characters? Or kind of wondering, especially towards the beginning, are his advances on her sexual in nature, or is he a dickish boss?
Right.
Which is another thing, as a film that just knows its craft really well, what do you think the film does to clue you in on the psychosexual nature of their relationship, rather than him just being a really mean boss in the beginning? I mean, by about halfway through, you know that it's sexual.
Right.
Probably before that, you know it's sexual. But at what point do you think you really realize that?
The only thing that I can... I mean, there's definite moments.
Mm-hmm.
The first alarm that kind of goes off is when the one secretary is leaving crying.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Yeah, right from the moment she's in the door.
There's this thing where the secretary is leaving crying, but then again, that could just mean that he's a mean boss.
Sure, yeah, it certainly
could.
That
he fires her because, you know, she's incapable and whatever.
Well, the hints become increasingly obvious as things go on.
Right,
right from we notice that, you know, the secretary wanted sign outside mm-hmm. clearly means there is a reoccurring issue. So much so that he had a nice sign made with lights around it
right.
and a switch that he can flip every yeah, time
and,
he needs
well,
a new secretary.
And furthermore, the other thing is that the sign has been on and off so many times that he's had to replace bulbs.
Yeah, yeah. I think one of the real giveaways for me is when he comments on her physical appearance. You know, he's interested, just from the beginning, he's interested in her personal life. The job interview questions
right.
are questions about what is her home life like, what is her personal basically trying to see if she is a masochist,
mm-hmm.
you know, asking different questions about her personal life, about pregnancy.
Right.
But then as in the first couple days or the first few moments of her job, he's also giving her these criticisms, but they're not really criticisms you would give a secretary. I mean, it could be argued that keeping up his image is really important, that she has to dress professionally or whatever.
Right.
But she's not really dressing that unprofessionally,
mm-hmm.
certainly not dressing any different than she did when she got the job. So I think his involvement in his interest in her physical attributes, you know, talking about sticking her tongue out, talking about what clothes she wears to
right.
work.
Tapping her feet,
right?
sniffing.
Well, he notices these small things like tapping her feet when, you know, his office is all the fucking way over there. So he's obviously taken almost what seems at first to be a creepy interest
yeah.
in her, you know, at the point where she's doing her laundry and he's there totally accidentally, but had they not shown us him walking in happenstance, we would think, is he stalking
right.
her? You know, there's almost something bizarre about that. There's enough for the film to sort of chew on in the beginning, but towards the end, it goes beyond it being a sexual relationship, especially by the point that she's, you know, circling want ads. I think it becomes mm-hmm. apparent that it's more than a sexual relationship when she's having problems with her boyfriend. I mean, the link that we see between her and her boyfriend isn't really one between a girlfriend and a boyfriend.
Right.
They're casual acquaintances who have some kind of weird sexual thing going. It's not even sexual. It's a
they
weird...
They are casual acquaintances where one of them has kind of wrangled the other one
yeah.
into guiltily going along with their preconceived relationship.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. To the point where she goes home with him and discovers that he, you know, thinks she's his soulmate. Isn't that what it's soulmate, the term he uses? Where she kind of goes, do you think that? And he like bashfully goes,
yeah.
But the look on her face is almost of horror, almost of disgust.
Fear, she doesn't, I think it's fear.
Sure, it's fear. So that's when things elevate back at work, where she has to kind of pressure Edward into, kind of ask him, in what's an unspoken dynamic between the two of them, is this just sex? It's something that you see in a lot of different relationships where you start out casually and then, you know, maybe you're just having sex with a girl and then you kind of wonder, is there a relationship there? Same thing is happening here. They're going through the same phases that a quote-unquote normal relationship would, where it's a sexual dynamic, and then is there something more here? But it's just different packaging. It's just a different lifestyle, and so you have to go at it in different ways. The film tries to make that really obvious when she's reading Cosmo, and she's trying to apply, you know, relation tips for the standard. Yeah. But well, first of all, no one should apply any Cosmo tips to anything ever. That's always going to fail, probably as bad
unless
as it does
unless you're seeing
in
a girl.
Film.
Two girls
seeing
each other. Who
both read Cosmo?
Should both read
Cosmo. Only if they both read Cosmo.
If both parties involved, or all parties involved, let's say.
Sure.
Let's be real, real liberal here.
That's very nice.
If they're all reading Cosmo, then it's probably okay.
You have a big Cosmo orgy, and then watch Sex and the City afterwards. So the territory the film gets in, finally, once the entire audience, I would imagine most of the audience who sees this film, or maybe that's just me being too open-minded here, too hopeful for a segment of society that I'm actually afraid of. But let's ignore them. Let's ignore the people who still aren't along for the ride, you know, two-thirds of the way through the film and are still like, this is weird. Most people, I think, believe that it's fine. And so the film presses it onto this other level, which a lot of people maybe are unfamiliar with or maybe not okay with, where they go, can we do this full-time? Is this a full-time thing? So I'm wondering at this point, the first question that kind of crosses my mind is, how do you feel about people living a BDSM lifestyle 24/7? I mean, that's the dynamic for their relationship.
Why not?
Totally fine with that.
Why not? Said it in the film, that's my response. Why not?
Yeah, it's almost puzzling to me to consider that. Really, I guess I've never really even thought about that before, but I have no qualms with that whatsoever. I think the film shows that that is a perfectly, maybe not natural, natural might not be the word, but I mean,
they're, I would say natural is fine.
Not average is what I mean. Not common.
Right.
Their sort of sadomasochism, their bond between the two of them is what leads her to stop cutting. I mean, him sort of taking control over her life, he says to her, you will never cut again. Mm-hmm. And this comes back to the feministic side of things.
Right.
And why I think that upon thinking about this at all, that it's all right, is that these are adults making conscious decisions for themselves.
Yeah.
When he tells her, you know, listen to me, you will never cut again, he's not actually putting her in shackles, or certainly not yet in the film. She can go, I'm going to leave.
Right.
I don't want to do this anymore. And in fact, the first time he spanks her, there's almost a second where she goes, you know, I've never really thought about this. Is this going to be okay? And she can make the decision to leave, but she has instead made the decision as a freely operating woman that she wants to be in that relationship. So I'm not going to say it's anti-feministic because a person wants to be dominated by another individual. I think if that's what they want, then that's totally fine.
Right.
I think what feminism is more about is not being dominated by force from, you know, obviously men being the other
because
end of
the
economy. But yeah, because you are a woman and having no other choice. I think that's a really feministic message to say that you have the choice, and if you want, you can be dominated. That's what safe words are for.
Well, to bring back the John Waters thing, it's if it's safe and consensual, there is no problem.
Always let John Waters be your guide, I believe is the message of the show. We have a email address in case you want to send us some messages.
Or pictures of you in chains naked.
With a saddle on your back and a carrot in your mouth at the Double Feature Show @gmail.com. We also have a website where unfortunately you can't find any of those things, but it is doublefeatureshow.com, and there's interesting stuff on there, albeit not naked pictures of anyone.
Right.
In other end of the show news, we got two new donations, which means two new Carnival Sideshow jobs this week. If you haven't heard this segment of the show before, we assign hypothetical carnival jobs to a non-existent sideshow to our listeners who donate.
Yeah.
We got a donation from Shannon, who will be working the bed of nails. We also got another donation from somebody who writes us pretty regularly named Matt. and Matt specifically requested that we give him a really good job. So I already gave up the job of management, which is debatably the most powerful job at this freak show, but I've been saving this one too. He gets to be the man-eating chicken. Now, of course, Double Feature won't be providing the chicken, so try and pick up a bucket of that before you make your way to work. Very thankful for both of those. You can send a donation by going to donate.doublefeatureshow.com. Of course, you'll be helping out the show, but more importantly, you will get a completely useless occupation for a hypothetical freak show that only exists in our minds. Donate.doublefeatureshow.com. So before we get to films that are coming up next week, there was a poster in Polyester. Did you catch the exploitation posters in that?
Oh, yeah.
There is a brief scene. Ilsa, was it, which Ilsa movie is it?
It's Ilsa She-Wolf of the SS.
And there's also a Faster Pussycat.
Ooh, Faster Pussycat, Kill Kill.
Yeah, we need to get some Faster Pussycat on this show. I know we keep talking about doing a Faster Pussycat thing, so keep looking for that. Not yet, but keep looking for it. It's going to happen eventually.
Yeah, it's got to happen.
What are the movies we're actually going to do next time on the show?
Next time we're going to do REC, which is the original version of Quarantine.
Sure.
Fuck Quarantine. And we're going to do The Million Dollar Hotel. So I guess we're seeing Jeremy Davies 2 weeks in a row.
Yeah, that's kind of weird. I don't know if I'm comfortable with that. But maybe it's like I have problems understanding foreign dialects. So maybe by exposing myself to Jeremy Davies talking over and over, I will understand what he's trying to communicate. And I won't need to watch all of my Jeremy Davies films with subtitles on.
All right. Watch more fucking film.
Bye. I mean, there is something very cute and very approachable, really. Yeah. Very approachable about it. And I think that's why the film draws in those different aspects, because it ultimately needs to be approachable in order to kind of have that conversation with the audience.
Well, that's what it does. It basically removes the comedy and instead gives it a hot beef injection. Sorry.
Is that all that was?
No, no. It basically removes...
Can you...
Yeah, just give me a second.
I hate you.